It was a marriage on the rocks, and it had been for several years.
What Maureen was talking to you about, ending the marriage, was that something new that came from her in March of 2019?
No.
He said he wanted to leave her. And, you know, he was very upset that she wouldn't come with him down south. And he was unhappy.
Maureen RG had laid out a plan to leave her marriage. She discussed it with her husband, Bill RG, on the night of April 3rd, 2019, before bed.
They talked about the kids. They talked about the state of their marriage. They were sad and they were heartbroken, but they knew this marriage could not be saved.
The next morning, one of them was dead. The other was missing. This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 186. Forty-one-year-old Maureen Argee was a quiet, caring mother, according to her friends. She had worked as a social worker for over 15 years. Her husband, 49-year-old Bill Argee, was a physician's assistant who worked only when needed. Despite the fact that he wasn't bringing in regular income, Bill did have an expensive, constant addiction. Bill Argee was a gambling addict, so much so that Maureen, his family, and friends held an intervention for him in 2018.
And who participated in this intervention beside yourself that you remember?
Maureen was there. His mother was there, his two sisters, Karen and Kelly, and Ray, Karen.
And what was the purpose of that intervention, sir?
He just needed to reset his life. He was out of control, bankrupt, in debt, had a ton of problems, and he just needed to reset.
After the intervention, Bill became estranged from his friends, and his marriage continued to deteriorate.
He was angry.
Angry at Maureen?
Yes.
You recall him using the word setting him up?
Yes, I do.
Maureen confided in her best friend, Megan.
She was sad because she was not sure where she was going to stay married.
From your interactions and discussions with Maureen, did that appear to be the source of her sadness?
Yes.
Based on your many conversations with your friend, your many interactions with him, with her over the years, at any point in the many years that you knew Maureen, did you ever have any concerns that she may try to harm herself or
No.
suicidal?
No.
Maureen saw the end of the marriage coming and filed for divorce in March of 2019. But Bill saw the end coming too. He complained about his marriage to friends as well.
Bill wanted to go down south because he had a couple job offers down there for a lot of money, almost double what he was making here. And it would be very lucrative for him to go down there and live. He's from Tennessee.
And what was the issue with his wife with respect to these plans?
His wife did not want to go. Again, he was very upset. He wanted to leave her. He was trying to figure out how he was going to get what he wanted.
All the venting and planning the two of them were doing to end their marriage became troubling to Maureen's friend Megan around March 27th. Maureen had told Megan that she was worried Bill might harm himself.
Was what Maureen wrote to you on March 28th and looking for firearms, was that in the context of her expressing thoughts that she may try to use a firearm against herself?
No.
Maureen was looking for firearms to make sure Bill wouldn't use one on himself. Even after assuring Megan that there were no firearms in the house, Megan was still worried about Maureen's safety.
Maureen never told you that she was afraid for her own safety?
She said that he postured one time in the doorway.
Mm-hmm. But Maureen never showed up unannounced needing a safe place to stay?
No.
She never asked you about domestic violence resources?
No.
But you worried about Maureen, right?
I did, yeah.
You worried about her safety?
I did.
And you asked her if she was safe at home?
Correct.
And she told you she was safe?
She said she felt safe.
She felt safe. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Megan was concerned about Maureen, but Maureen was concerned about Bill, and she wasn't the only one. That same day, Bill had mentioned wanting to harm himself to his friend, David.
Did he also directly threaten to take his own life?
He did. Yes, sir.
What did he say to you in substance with respect to that?
He said that he had a gun at his house and he could go over at any time and shoot himself in the head.
And did he explain to you why he would take his own life?
He said that he wanted to show Maureen the same pain that she was giving him.
He wanted to inflict pain on his wife, right?
Yes.
And that's what he told you.
On the morning of April 4th, 2019, 3 days after that conversation with his friend, Bill got his children off to school. He sent a note to let their teacher know that their grandmother would be picking them up from after-school care. He signed it, Maureen and Bill RG. It was an unusual request, because typically the children were picked up by one of their parents. At the end of the day, no one showed up to pick them up. The after-school staff called Bill's mom, and she came to get them. She was seemingly unaware of the arrangement. Meanwhile, no one could reach Bill or Maureen. A welfare check was made to their home at 118 West Road in Londonbury, New Hampshire. Officer Mallory Littman entered the home and found Maureen's body lying on her bed. There were signs of blood in various places throughout the house.
Were apparent blood-stained items found in a trash can?
Yes, they were.
And what items in particular that you recall being recovered from the kitchen area?
Bloody tissues and paper towels, as well as medical non-adhesive wrapping, the wrappings for it, as well as ripped up pieces of paper.
And those ripped up pieces of paper, where were they found in the kitchen?
In the trash can.
Investigators would later find out that the blood matched both Maureen and Bill. Bill RG was nowhere to be found. New Hampshire police began to look for him. He was located the next day, April 5th, at a casino in Connecticut. As the officers approached, Bill told them he was so relieved that they had found them. Sergeant Matthew Amatucci told him about his wife's death.
When you first met with the defendant, did you tell him that his wife was dead?
I did.
And what was the defendant's reaction when you told him that his wife was dead?
There was no verbal or emotional response. He just looked at me with really no response at all.
Bill walked outside with the officers.
What happened when he was outside?
The captain spoke to him, and basically after a few minutes, he indicated that he had tried to hurt himself by committing suicide. And at that time, the decision was made to transport him to the hospital.
The officers accompanied him to the hospital and spoke with him while he lay in the bed.
Did medical staff check on him?
Yes.
And when they asked him why he was in the hospital, what did he do?
He turned his palms upwards, and he demonstrated, or he was showing where he had tried to cut his wrist.
And did he say why he tried to hurt himself?
Yeah, he said that he's not liking life right now, basically.
Did he say how old the wounds were?
Well, he said he did it around 11 a.m. within the last 24 hours.
Okay, so he said that 11 a.m. the day before?
Yes.
Sergeant Amatucci and investigator Stephen Sloper then interviewed Bill for about an hour and 15 minutes. Sergeant Amatucci would later tell a courtroom that Bill never asked about what had happened to his wife. After the news broke about Maureen's death, police received a call from one of Bill's friends, who owned a casino Bill would often gamble at.
I got a call the morning of Maureen's death from a friend of mine, and I immediately called the Londonderry Police Department to volunteer some information that I might have in regards to what transpired.
James Timbus had known Bill for about 8 years. He was part owner of the Poker Room, and after Bill would come in to gamble, they became friends. He noticed in January 2019 that Bill seemed to be low on money. They were at a group dinner, and it was Bill's turn to pay. He couldn't.
To your knowledge, did the defendant owe money to other gamblers at the time of his wife's death?
Yes, he did.
In the weeks leading up to the death of the defendant's wife, was he continuing to gamble at your business and lose money at your business?
Well, I think a couple weeks before Maureen's death, he was at my place, and he was playing at a table, and he moved to our table, and he had a lot of money in front of him, and he ended up losing the money, and he asked me to loan him $1,000, which I did not do. He had had dinner, he had drinks, he had a massage from the massage girl, and he said he would be right back, and that was the last time I saw him.
James told police that on February 13th, 2019, he and Bill went to eat at an Italian restaurant, a place they went to often. They sat at the bar.
He told me, as I said, that he had a $400,000 insurance policy on his wife. And I asked him if she knew about the policy. He said no. And he said, I'll give you half of the money if you help me kill my wife. And I said, Doc, you know, please don't talk crazy to me. He said, no, I'm serious. And I said, please, I'm not interested. I don't want to have this conversation. And then he said, if you can find me a hitman to do it, I will give you a piece of the insurance money. And can I repeat what I said to him?
So we're all adults, and I've said the word fuck in front of the jurors before. So let's talk about what was said during this conversation.
I said, are you out of your fucking mind? I said, I don't want to have this conversation. I want nothing to do with this. I said, I really don't want anything to do with this.
As for why Bill said he wanted his wife dead, he said he hated her and was having financial problems. After James told him he wouldn't do it, he said Bill never brought it up again. In fact, Bill tried to walk it back, blaming it on his drinking. On June 7th, 2019, Bill Argy was arrested and charged with Maureen's murder. But he claimed it wasn't murder at all.
Maureen Argy had plans for her future. She was a 41-year-old mother of two young children who was about to start her life over again. A life with so much to look forward to. Her children, her family and friends, and a likely promotion doing a job that she loved. And importantly, a life without her husband, the defendant. But the defendant was not going to let that happen on her terms. He couldn't handle that. He wasn't going to allow that.
Prosecutor Heather Cherniske told the jury that while Maureen's life was looking up, Bill's was the opposite. She said although Bill proudly presented himself as a physician's assistant, he was unwilling and unable to maintain steady employment. His bank account was in the negatives, and he was talking about filing for bankruptcy. She said Bill was a frequent gambler and would lose his family's money at the poker table. On the day before her murder, Maureen interviewed for a promotion at work. Later, she discussed her planned living arrangements with Bill's sister and mother.
The plan was for Maureen to take their children to live in Manchester with the defendant's mother. The defendant, on the other hand, he was also talking about his living arrangements on April 3rd. But instead of making the plans, he was being told the plan. That he would be living alone without his children, hours away in Maine, at his mother's vacation home. And he wasn't happy about that. And to him, there was only one person to blame for that. And the very next day, the defendant murdered Maureen.
Prosecutor Chernisky told the jury that Bill and Maureen had two children, ages 9 and 6. They were interviewed after the murder by an interviewer trained in speaking with children. When they woke up that morning, Bill told them that their mom was sleeping and wasn't feeling well, that they needed to leave her alone and couldn't touch her. She said after Bill murdered Maureen, he tried to escape the consequences of what he did by attempting suicide.
You will see the surveillance video from the neighbor's security camera showing him leave the house that morning. You will then see surveillance video and a receipt from Home Depot where the defendant went and bought razors. The neighbor's camera then shows him returning. And when he got home with razors in hand, he slit his wrists.
She said he failed and didn't die.
You will see pictures of the bloody trail he left behind from that failed attempt. So the defendant bandaged up his injuries. He took care of himself. He showed concern for himself. But he showed no concern for Maureen. For Maureen, he left her to rot in her bed.
She said while Maureen was in her bed, deceased, Bill drove away with her phone.
And when he took her phone, he took with it all of the messages that he sent to Maureen in the weeks leading up to her murder. So while you will hear about all of the terrible things the defendant said about Maureen behind her back, you are deprived of seeing what he said directly to Maureen.
She said while Bill was gambling at a casino in Connecticut afterwards, he was ignoring phone calls from concerned family members. She told the jury she isn't clear on what the defense is going to say. They might propose that Maureen killed herself, she said.
A claim of suicide contrary to all you will hear about Maureen from those who knew her best, her friends and family. That she was a loving, devoted, attentive mother of two young children. That she was eager for a promotion that she was likely to receive interviewing on April 3rd for the director of public housing in Methuen, Massachusetts. That she was taking steps and plans to move out of her home, again, up till April 3rd, choosing how to set up her new home for her children with her friend.
She said the medical evidence also didn't point to a suicide.
And just as all that you will learn about Maureen is at odds with the claim of suicide, such a claim is also at odds with the medical evidence. An autopsy was performed on Maureen's body. Because of how the defendant left his victim's body, the medical examiner could not determine the exact way that Maureen was killed. She found that Maureen was killed by asphyxiation, either from another person strangling her or another person smothering her. The medical examiner, without qualification, concluded that Maureen's death was a homicide.
One of the state's star witnesses was Bill's friend, James Trimbus. He recalled for the jury how Bill had offered to give him half the insurance money if he agreed to kill Maureen. He was asked if Bill told him how he wanted her to be murdered.
He wanted to make it look like a suicide.
And did he also talk about how she was sometimes depressed?
He said that she suffered from depression, and we wanted to make it look like a suicide.
Yes. And that's how the defendant explained he wanted people to believe his murder was a suicide because she suffered from depression?
Yes.
He said Bill had made other concerning comments about his wife previously, too.
That he hated her, that he found her disgusting, that she was fat, that unattractive, just horrible things. I mean, he said terrible things about his wife on a regular basis.
James said Bill got more vile over the months leading up to her death. He was asked if Bill had ever spoken violently about Maureen before.
I remember sitting next to him one day at the poker table, and he turned to me and he said, "You know, if you stick a hypodermic needle in someone with nothing in it while they're sleeping, that they would die and no one would ever know how they died." And I said, "Doc, what are you talking about?" He said, "I'm just telling you, the air bubble will go into them and they would die and it would look like a heart attack or an embolism or something. And, you know, I don't remember him saying the perfect crime, but he said, and I said, "Doc, what are you talking about?" He said, nothing. Why are you talking crazy? I remember having that conversation with him.
In addition to that conversation, would you hear the defendant talk and threaten to kill his wife, other than that act of solicitation at the restaurant?
Yes. He often said that he would be better off without her. Yes, he did.
Bill's attorney was doubtful those conversations had ever happened. She also wanted to know why James hadn't said anything before Maureen's death.
Or the conversation never happened.
The conversation did happen.
You didn't mark it in the calendar, did you?
No.
You didn't tell anybody at the bar, did you?
I went home and told my wife that night. And I went back into the poker room the next day and I told people what happened. Yes, I did. But as I said,
you didn't call the police that somebody attempted to solicit you to commit murder, did you?
He said it often to me. I didn't take it seriously. I did not take it seriously.
She asked James about an argument he had had with Bill, pointing to various text messages he had recently sent.
Did you send a text that said, "You know, you're a piece of shit"?
Yes.
"You owe everybody money in here, including my establishment, and you were at Chase, is playing high stakes. You're a fucking dog."
I did send that text.
You were just disappointed.
Yeah, I was disappointed. I was annoyed.
You were annoyed?
Yeah, I was.
"And I will catch up with you. You are a shameful gambler. I have eyes in all the poker rooms, and the next time that I hear you're in a poker room, I'm going to show up and it's going to be fucking ugly."
Yes.
That sound like something you would say?
I did say that. I sent them that text.
Because you were angry.
I was annoyed.
And that's the last thing on the text. And a few days later, you heard about the suspicious death in Londonderry.
Yes.
And the last message on your text was that ugly text.
That was not my last text to him.
And the next text you say,
"What did you do? You need to reach out to me." That's what I said.
Right.
That was my last text to him. Yes.
But James wasn't the only person who said Bill had talked about having Maureen killed. His friend Don LaRochelle testified, too.
The defendant also, in conversations with you, talk about killing his wife, Maureen.
He did.
And about when did those conversations occur in relation to the intervention in March of 2018?
In the year or two prior to that.
What did the defendant say to you in those conversations that you remember, killing his wife?
He basically, you know, part of the conversation was, "All right, Bill, you're gonna go down to South. Maureen's not gonna go. She's gonna take half of everything. So you're gonna make twice as much money, but you're gonna write a check right back to Maureen up here." And he didn't want to hear any of that.
And with respect to killing his wife, what would he say about that?
Again, he said, I'll do it, or I'll hire somebody, or I'll, you know what I mean?
So employment and money issues were reasons the defendant talked to you about killing his wife?
Yeah.
What about the kids? Was the kids also another reason?
He loved his kids. He just, he wanted them. It was like possessions.
What about paying child support for him based on conversations that he had with you?
It was unacceptable to him. It was losing money.
Bill also allegedly told his neighbor that he blamed Maureen for taking everything from him. This just days before she was found dead.
What was the defendant saying about his wife's role in the problems that he was discussing with you, that you recall?
He blamed her for most of it.
For most of it?
If not all of it, yes.
Well, according to what you told the investigators, the defendant thought that she had taken everything from him. Right?
Yes, I did say that.
According to what you told investigators, the defendant told you a couple of times that he believed she had taken everything from him, right?
Yes.
And he seemed angry, right?
Yes.
Christine James was the medical examiner who performed the autopsy on Maureen. She testified that she initially ruled the cause of death in her report as probable homicidal asphyxia.
And what did you list in your report as the rationale for that determination?
Sure. So based on all of the autopsy findings, the injuries that she had to her face, to her tongue, to her neck are very non-specific in general. But put together, they mean something as a package. I also ruled out any natural disease process. She only had gallstones that would not be fatal. She had no evidence of infection. She had no evidence of cancer. I looked at the ADME's report. There's no evidence of any environmental cause. She didn't die of hypothermia, or carbon monoxide. There was no evidence of a suicide note present at the scene. So I take all of that information together, and all I am left with are these injuries to her face and neck and a very suspicious circumstance at the scene. So I ruled it a homicide due to homicidal asphyxiation. Because of her injuries, them being not very specific, I couldn't tell how the homicidal asphyxia occurred, whether it be a smothering, a suffocation, or a strangulation, or a combination of those things.
But she said she would make a different determination now.
Now, Dr. James, I believe that you listed, and you testified that you listed it as probable homicidal asphyxiation. So it's now been over 2 years since Ms. Arge's autopsy. No, months since your deposition, do you still believe that there was anything in regard to her positioning at death that would lead you to believe that it was probable homicidal asphyxiation versus just homicidal asphyxiation?
Sure. So at the time, I used probable again because one of the main findings that we see frequently with asphyxial deaths are petechial hemorrhages within the eyes that can be obscured by that liver mortis from the blood pooling in her eyes. So I didn't have that, so that made me uncomfortable at the time. However, there's no evidence of any decomposition with Ms. Argy. There's no tardo spots, which are those post-mortem hemorrhages. So given that, I was comfortable calling it homicidal asphyxia.
So as you sit here today, would your determination as to cause of death be homicidal asphyxia?
Yes. If I was writing this report today, I would take out probable.
Bill's attorneys had a problem with this new determination. According to their cross-examination, the ruling had been probable until right before trial.
And you're saying that you just now realize that did not exist?
No, ma'am. So I did not document any tardo spots at autopsy, but it's 2 years later. I have more experience. I feel more comfortable now calling this an outright homicide than I did then.
And I deposed you this summer, correct?
Yes.
You didn't tell me that you changed your opinion at that time, did you?
I did not.
So you've had about 2 months to reconsider your opinion after the deposition?
Yes, ma'am.
And when did you first notify the state that you changed your opinion?
yesterday I just made a flippant remark that I would call it outright.
Bill's attorney continued to question how and when she reached her new determination.
So you completed your report on May 14th.
Yes, the report was finalized on May 14th, 2019.
Before you completed a report, you talked to the lead investigator in this case.
Yes.
And because you were probably giving him the information from the toxicology report that's finished on March 29th.
I don't know if I gave him those results.
But he gave you information.
Yes.
And he gave you information about the investigation.
Correct.
And then you completed the autopsy. With that information, you completed the autopsy report. Is that correct?
Yes, the autopsy report was completed on May 14, 2019.
And after talking to the lead investigator, you concluded, in my opinion, that Maureen Argee, a 41-year-old white female, died as a result of a probable homicide asphyxiation, which may include manual strangulation and or smothering. Did I read that? Is that correct?
Correct. That's how it's written.
And I asked you questions back on July the 26th, very similar to the ones I'm asking today, right?
Yes.
And it was yesterday that you decided that you had enough experience to determine that it's no longer probable. Is that right? I'm sorry, I just asked a yes or no question. Is that right?
Yes. Okay, if I was signing out the report today, I would not put probable.
Maureen Argee's death was not a homicide. It was a suicide. Praveen Dunn, Bill's attorney, told the jury in her opening statements. She said we may never know exactly why Maureen did what she did. She left no note and told no one of the plan. She described Bill finding Maureen's body, wedged between the bed and the nightstand, a sheet wrapped tightly around her neck, and the other end tied to one of the bedposts. She said Bill's main thought was that he couldn't let the children see their mom like that, so he removed the sheet, placed Maureen back in bed, and covered her with a blanket. He then got the kids out of the house, came back and tried to kill himself, bandaged his wrists, and then left again.
His actions upon waking may be hard to understand, and the state will paint his choices as evidence of a guilty conscience. But again, life hands us no script for how to react to tragedy. And Bill's choices were a reaction to tragedy, not to murder. He woke up in a room covered in his blood, his deceased wife in the bed next to him, and as that scene came into focus, he could see this did not look good.
She said his actions in the hours that followed were due to shock and trauma. She said Bill was an addict and gambling was his drug of choice. Instead of feeling his grief, he went to the casino. And when police came the next day, Bill told them he was relieved they had found them. She said when Maureen died, Bill was an easy target for the blame. As for the attempted solicitation, she said to consider the source of the info. If James's story was true, why didn't he call the police right away? The defense's star witness was Bill Argee. Now, one thing I want to point out before we get into his testimony is that during direct, Bill is very slow with his answers. He often takes extremely long pauses. I edit them out for easier listening, but as you'll hear, his attorney does bring this up a little later.
Bill, let's cut right to it. Did you murder your wife, Maureen Argee?
I did not, ma'am.
Bill told the jury that he and Maureen had gotten into an argument in their living room on the night of April 3rd, 2019. They were arguing over what would happen when they divorced and their assets. He said at one point he had taken out his phone and showed her a picture of empty wine bottles from a couple nights prior. He said he told her it looks like she has a drinking problem.
I said, you want to go there. It looks like you have a drinking problem. So if we present this in front of a judge, gambling's an addiction. Alcohol is an addiction. I told her I highly doubt that a judge is going to hand two kids to an alcoholic.
After their argument, he felt annoyed and overwhelmed, so he left the room. He said he first went downstairs to the basement to watch TV, but then decided to go for a walk. He estimated it was sometime after 11 p.m.
How long were you out on your walk?
Walked around the block, I'd probably say 20 minutes max.
When he got home, he went to the living room, but Maureen was no longer there. He figured she had gone to bed. He told the court that for the last few years, he had been sleeping on the couch.
Not necessarily because of marital things, more because of I have sleeping difficulties from whether it be job related, working nights or so usually I would, instead of having to wake up Maureen, I usually just slept downstairs sometimes.
When asked if he went upstairs to change, he said no, that people make fun of him sometimes, but he typically sleeps in his attire from the day. The following morning, he woke up a little before 7 a.m., the first in his house to wake up. He said that wasn't unusual. He went through his usual morning routine and then went to wake up the kids. He wasn't working that day, so he knew he was the one who had to make lunches and get the kids ready. At some point, he said he noticed the cellar doors were closed. Usually, Maureen would go down there to work out. He went down to check, but she wasn't there. He said he assumed she had just slept in, but it was starting to get late. He went up to the bedroom.
I know this may be difficult, Bill, but what did you see when you went into your bedroom?
I saw my wife with a bed sheet around her neck and jammed between her nightstand and her in the bed. And
how was her body positioned?
She was cocked to the right.
Was she lying down? Was she seated up?
She was kind of, I don't know how to describe it. She was not in a full seating position. I believe that if the nightstand wasn't there, that she would have fell to the ground.
Okay. You said she was in between the bed and the nightstand?
Yes.
There was an empty space between the bed and the nightstand? And you said there was a sheet wrapped around her neck. Where was the other end of that sheet?
Wrapped around the post of our bedside.
She asked what he did when he saw her. He said he went to her immediately, then shut their door.
Picked her up. Took the sheet off her. I laid her down. Initially, I checked for her pulse. She didn't have a pulse. I gave her two rescue breaths as she wasn't breathing.
When you say you laid her down, where did you lay her?
On the bed.
Why did you do that? Why did you move Maureen's body from between the nightstand and the bed to on the bed?
So I was afraid that if my kids ever saw that, they could never see that. I just held her and cried.
He was asked if he called 911 and he said no. He knew she was dead and he was worried about the kids seeing.
Being in the medical field, I've had to call 911 for patients before. And the response is anybody and everybody. It's very much needed at times. And sometimes it's not, but they don't know. So
So they send everybody and anybody.
So you were worried about the kids seeing Maureen. Sorry. You were also worried about them seeing police cars, ambulances, fire engines. Is that a yes?
Yes.
He said he got their kids ready for school and then sent them along with the note. Then he went to Home Depot. Upon returning home, he said he wanted to take his own life.
So how did you try to kill yourself upstairs in the bedroom?
I cut both wrists vertically.
So after cutting both wrists, what did you do?
Laid down next to Maureen. I held her. I said, if this is the way we're going to go, then we're going to do it together.
He said he didn't leave a note. At some point, he woke up.
I realized what I'd done, but in trying to cut my wrist, I went into the bathroom, tried to attend to the wounds.
So you take some very long pauses in your testimony. What's up with pauses?
This isn't easy.
This isn't easy.
This might be 2 years for some people, but it feels like it was yesterday for me.
He said he then made a second attempt to take his life.
Attempted to take your life again, how?
I recut the areas.
But again, clearly that did not work.
Bill said at that point he just had to leave the house, so he packed a bag.
I brought the knife that I had cut myself with.
Okay. Anything else?
The sheet that Maureen hung herself with.
Why did you bring that?
When I took it off, I'd just thrown it on the floor. It was more of just grabbing things.
Okay. So did you put it into a bag?
I did.
What else did you put into that bag?
I had Maureen's cell phone and my phone.
He said he brought Maureen's phone because it had been on the nightstand next to her. He said he thought maybe it would contain answers as to why this happened. After packing his bag, he left and headed for what he considered a safe place, a casino.
I wanted to get to somewhere that was safe and also that was public and that if I needed to be found, I knew I could be found.
He described how he felt when the police showed up at the casino.
There was a little confusion, but a little relief.
Why relief?
Because I had a pretty good idea why they were there.
And why was that you thought they were there?
Because they probably wanted to talk to me about my wife being deceased.
Did you think that you were a suspect or a person of interest in her death?
Absolutely not.
When the prosecution began their cross, they first focused on the picture they said Bill had tried to paint of his wife on direct.
So, according to you, Maureen was a suicidal drunk who neglected her kids, right?
That's not what I said, sir.
Wasn't that the portrait that you were trying to paint to these jurors before the lunch recess?
That's the portrait that you're trying to portray, sir.
That would be an inaccurate portrait of Maureen, wouldn't it?
That you're trying to portray? Yes, sir.
That she was a suicidal drunk who neglected her kids, right? That would be inaccurate, right, Mr. Archie?
That you're trying to portray? Yes, sir.
And that would be a despicable character attack on Maureen, wouldn't it?
It would.
The truth is Maureen adored her kids, right?
Maureen was a good mother.
She was a great mother to her kids, right?
She was a great mother.
Prosecutor Peter Hinckley pointed out that Bill didn't call 911. Nor did he call any of Maureen's family members to let them know what had happened.
You didn't use that phone that you had access to call Maureen's brother, who truly loved her, to tell her that she was to tell him that she was dead, did you?
Nope. And I regret that for the rest of my life.
You also didn't use that phone to contact any of the many other people who truly love Maureen to tell them that she was dead, right?
I did not.
And you didn't use that phone to call 911, right?
What would 911 do, sir?
Prosecutor Hinckley then questioned Bill about the alleged suicide and how that would be possible.
So you claim that your wife's body was wedged in between the bed and the nightstand when you found her corpse, right?
Correct.
Now, you understand as a smart guy that a necessary component of hanging is that the body needs to be suspended.
Right? Correct.
But according to your account, the body was wedged in between the bed and the nightstand, not suspended.
The wedge is part of the suspension.
Somebody's wedged in and not suspended by the ligature, right? Which is it? Was she wedged or was she suspended?
No, she was wedged. Do you understand what wedged means, sir?
I'm trying to figure it out. I think the jurors are too.
Okay. Would you like me to explain?
Please, I think we'd all do
that. Okay. So as I testified that she was wedged on her right side. So what was holding her up was her left butt cheek was hitting the nightstand, and the rest of her body was wedged in between.
So she wasn't held up by the ligature?
She was held up by the ligature, but the full weight was not, she was not down on the ground.
Prosecutor Hinckley noted that there was a bruise on Maureen's neck. He asked Bill how that would have gotten there.
On the right side? So if somebody has a sheet around their neck and the weight is on the right side, do you understand the concept of a noose and the tightening?
If only we had that sheet so you could demonstrate for us, Prosecutor Hinckley said. He asked where the sheet is now, and Bill said he doesn't know.
Where's your phone? Where's the phone that you had had this photograph of the two open wine bottles that showed that Maureen was a drunk?
That phone is, as far as I know, up in Maine.
And where is Maureen's cell phone?
Unfortunately, the phone went dead, and when driving, I got frustrated that I would not continue to have the phone, and I threw it out on 395.
You abandoned the phone just like you abandoned your dead wife, Prosecutor Hinckley said, to which Bill insisted he did not abandon his wife. He was asked if he ever complained about his wife to others, and he said no. Prosecutor Hinckley asked him to look at the jury and say that.
I would never say anything bad about my wife.
You would never say any hateful things about your wife, right? Let them know that it's the truth.
I would say never anything hateful about my wife.
You never said anything threatening towards your wife, right?
I never said anything threatening towards my wife.
Bill said his friends who testified against him were lying.
And it's your testimony that you never told any of your family members or friends, and specifically those who testified this past week, that you never or didn't want to pay child support.
That is my testimony.
And the statements that the jurors heard from Dan LaRochelle, it's your testimony that you never made those statements.
About child support?
About killing your wife for child support.
I never told Dan LaRochelle that I would kill my wife.
And Dan LaRochelle would lie about that because?
I'll tell you what I did tell him.
My question is, Dan LaRochelle would lie about that because?
I'm not concerned. I don't know. I will tell you that he is lying.
And Jamie Tempest is also lying about the solicitation at the restaurant that he showed the jurors text messages regarding that meeting.
Correct.
Both the prosecution and the defense presented a very different chain of events for what happened to Maureen Argee. The defense claimed Bill had come across his wife's body after she had died by suicide.
How does anyone react to finding a spouse who died from suicide with two kids in the house? Bill chose to make sure that his kids did not see her with a ligature around her neck. And he chose to make sure that they did not see the home by having his mother pick them up. But after that, as we all talked about during the trial, Bill's an addict. What do addicts do under stress? They run to the source of the addiction. And that's what Bill did. He could think of nothing but getting to a casino where he can escape from the reality of his wife's death.
The prosecution said that Bill had murdered Maureen and that the theory of a suicide was insulting.
So let's begin with the defense claim in this case. Maureen Argee took her own life. From the tale that finally came out on Friday, it's a ridiculous story wholly made up from his guilty imagination. And it's also demeaning and it's insulting, not only to the credible evidence and to your own common sense, but also to who Maureen truly was. It's a smear attack on the character of someone who he made damn sure cannot defend herself. It's just what you would expect from the same bitter, self-centered man who held Maureen and her children down for so long. It's more false blame casting by the man who constantly did that up until he killed her and continued even after her death, what you all heard from him on Friday.
The jury deliberated briefly before returning with their verdict: guilty of first-degree murder and falsification of criminal evidence. At his sentencing, Maureen's loved ones spoke about their loss, about the mother, daughter, sister, niece, cousin, and friend she was. Bill spoke too, saying that there are no words that can be spoken about Maureen's death. But he called the trial a cruel injustice and said there were multiple errors. He said he believes the Heavenly Father is looking down and knows the truth. Bill Argee was sentenced to life in prison. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at Court Junkie, by tweeting me at Court Junkie Pod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. This case was researched and written by Polly Katowski and me, Jillian Jalali. Follow Polly on Instagram at Polly Katowski. I got a lot of really great listener request emails, which I love because I always want to cover cases you want to hear. So if you have any case ideas for the show, please send an email to podcast@courtjunkie.com and put listener request in the subject line. The catch is that the case has to have gone through the court system somehow. I don't do unresolved cases, but thanks to everybody who has sent one, and keep them coming. And to hear these episodes without the ads and to hear additional Court Junkie bonus episodes, check out my Patreon options at courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.